Hi, welcome to Live Culture. I'm your host, Martha Willett Lewis, and I'm here today with Power Booth, who is an artist, an educator, and thinker, and we're going to have a freewheeling discussion about all kinds of things. Hi, Power. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi, Martha.
Wonderful. Okay. I want you a little closer to the mic.
Great. So,
just to say a few words about you, your work is in major collections, including the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Guggenheim and the Whitney, and you used to do quite a lot of theater work as well, and you've been an educator. You are an educator. You were dean of the Hartford Art School, and you helped build the Renee Samuels Center, which is a studio facility focused on teaching art and technology, among other things. Is there anything else from your resume that you want to highlight here?
That's just enough. That's great.
Okay. Okay.
So it is the Hartford Art School.
It's the Hartford
Art
School, right?
Hartford. Yeah.
Right.
And I continue to teach there, even though I'm no longer dean.
And what are you teaching?
I teach painting, and I also have developed a course on art and complexity.
Oh, interesting.
So it's a way of introducing art students, but this course is open to anyone across the campus. So we get a wide range of students with lots of different interests. And
I think that's great. It's good to get a mixture of kinds of
It's called Chaos, Complexity, and the Visual Arts.
Nice. And this sort of brings up a running thread through your work, and one of the reasons why I enjoy talking to you is that you have a strong science connection with a lot of the things that you're interested in. You're very interested in human consciousness. You did the Cognitive Theory in the Arts Symposium, Art, Body, Mind, and you're involved
out in Berkeley.
Yeah.
And this is when I first met George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. And Mark is an astonishing philosopher at the University of Oregon who has, I think, applied cognitive science to the visual arts in the most astonishing way.
And does this influences your own work as well as what you're teaching.
Yeah, and I never think of it as a direct influence. Mm-hmm. It is the landscape around the work that I do, but it isn't a direct connection. It doesn't work that way. Mark Johnson's primary interest has, or a thread that runs through his work, is the astonishing degree to which metaphoric processes shape our thinking. In fact, it's how we think.
Right.
And
right now we use a lot
revolutionary.
Use a lot of things that describe how we think as being like computers.
We always use something else to describe what
we absolutely
mean. Yeah.
But it also tends to be whatever is the flavor of the moment, technologically speaking.
Absolutely. Yes. So Newton, the way to understand Newton was to think of the universe as a mechanical.
Right. The clockwork universe. Yeah.
The clockwork universe. So as we move through our history, we, as Mark has said, every concept is metaphoric. There is no literal concept.
I've actually done art projects based on this, based on science books, popular science books that use metaphors and analogies with regular, ordinary objects, partly because they're trying to describe something that's very difficult to grasp, which is presumably what this whole book is about, like the difficulty of doing that. And that's really intriguing to me.
It's not just difficult. It's impossible.
So I would disagree. I think it's that you're talking about really complicated things. It's a model. And when you say it's a model for thinking about it, it doesn't do everything. It is not a replacement for the thing. It's a way of visualizing it enough to get your head around it.
But think of it, if you can think of it this way, if you were to say what reality is, mm-hmm. without a perspective, without a point of view, without a subjective, without us looking at it as a subject, there's no stance you can take for that literal perspective, because we'd have to take ourselves out of the picture.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this concept of the universe being mind independent.
Yes.
And I would agree with that. But we can't step out of our subjectivity, because we always have a point of view. Otherwise, we can't make sense of anything.
Right. We're participants in the play that we're in.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I want to talk a little bit about your career doing theater with that in mind, because you worked a lot with Richard Foreman, and I always think of Richard Foreman, his brand of theater, the Ontological Hysterical Theater Company, as being sort of entering into his own brain with these kinds of conversations happening. How did you end up doing that, and what kinds of visuals were you making, and how does that relate to the work that you do in your own studio?
I became friends with a composer named Stanley Silverman, mm-hmm. and he...
This is in New York.
In New York City, and I'm just there as a young artist, but I had met Stanley, and Stanley wanted somebody to design his production that wasn't a typical set designer.
Mm-hmm.
So he decided I was going to design it. And then he said, I'm really interested in this playwright, young playwright, Richard Foreman. And his first play is Down Where You Are on Wooster Street.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down, and he was actually in Maciunas's building.
Right.
That's Fluxus. Richard's
building,
very involved with Fluxus.
Right.
And approximately
when was this? In the 70s?
It is, no, 68.
Mm-hmm.
68. It was that spring, or it was the winter, 67, 68.
Right. That was quite the year, by the way.
Yes, yeah. On lots of levels.
On lots of levels. Anyway, sorry, go back. So it was on
that could be a whole show.
It could be, 1968.
Right. So I walked into a theater piece.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually Jonas Mekas's. He had created the first film anthology at 30, I think it was 30 Wooster Street. And he couldn't show any films because the city had decided his little auditorium he'd created was illegal.
Really?
Yes.
It's a fire hazard or?
Oh, he couldn't pass inspections because of whatever. But the real truth was that there needed to be some money under the table to the inspectors, and he wouldn't do it.
He
was so principled.
Right.
So there's this little stage and theater setup that is sitting there empty because he can't show films legally. So Richard,
but you can use it for other things?
No. So
Richard,
this whole thing's illegal in the eyes of the city. So Richard decided to do a production there. And
of course,
and
because
this
when
is
something
his first
isn't legal, why
play.
Not just open it up to the public?
Yeah, he's in his mid-20s, and I'm in my early 20s, and we don't know what we're doing. But Richard produced a piece that I have to say had the most astonishing curtain.
What did it look like?
Okay, so he had built a set out of plywood and a bunch of junk.
Oh, he made his own set.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, Richard lights, does the sound work, writes the production, and
well, he is modeling his own brain. So
yeah, he's just it's a
multi-sensory,
absolutely, and astonishing work. So here's this, and Ernie Geer, the filmmaker, was one of the performers. He got normal people to perform because he couldn't afford to get actors.
Right.
And so they're
was that
just
really why, or was it that he wanted to create a different kind of theater? Because it seems to me that his
I think it's partially practical as well as he comes out of Yale, and he's in New York, and he's trying to put something together. And I think if he thought it like a tableau painting in a way, it's a very visual, but the sound is very important.
Right. The sound is extremely important in
right.
his work.
And he didn't like acting.
Yeah.
So I think it was a good choice. He wanted people on stage, but he didn't want actors.
Right.
Because they weren't going to act. They were going to, I think of it in some ways as they were going to perform tasks.
Yeah, I think of them as a little bit like psychological experiments, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, tests.
So imagine this. You walk in, and there's a loud buzzer sound. Mm-hmm. It's so annoying. Your senses are shutting down.
Yes.
And there's Richard sitting there at the top of the, at the back of the raked seats, which mm-hmm. are just like scaffolding. It's just very crudely put together, really. And Richard's sitting back there with his sound system, and it's just this, I don't want to even go there.
Don't imitate it, please.
Yeah, and you're sitting there, and you don't realize it, but all your senses are like shut down. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, these performers come out, and there's a dangling light bulb, and that's your light, and there's some... And the performers come out, and he cuts off the sound. I literally realized my eyes just... The curtain went away. The sound mm-hmm. went away. So all of a sudden, everything's luscious.
Yeah. You're focused. You're totally focused.
Oh, totally.
Too. Yeah.
And I thought, it took me probably years later to think about it. Of course, that's a curtain. It was a sound curtain. Mm-hmm. And he just lifted that curtain, and my eyes were like, bam.
That's kind of brilliant. He also manages, that's what I mean by a test. It's kind of physically stressing you out so that there's the laboratory result that you want at the end, right? Which is,
well, it comes back to my body, my mm-hmm. embodied
right.
sense. And then because he didn't want them to actually speak the words he'd written for mm-hmm. them in any way that sounded like acting. Yes. It was a device I don't think I saw him use in any other play, but in that first play, it was called Angel Face. Mm-hmm. The script, he read this. No, yeah, the actors read the script mm-hmm. independently of the play, and he had that on tape. And so the sound of the speech, he would hit a button, and it's on his little tape recorder. This is back
so
in the...
So they kind of lip-sync it?
And they would lip sync, but they would lip sync in slow motion.
Ooh, creepy. Yeah.
So the person on stage mm-hmm. is saying, I am a... But the tape is, I'm opening the door.
Right. So is this cognitive disconnect?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole play was done this way.
Yes, that's... Yeah.
And one of the... images of the play that I loved a lot was something, again, I think was an accident. Mm-hmm. I've never really talked to Richard about this, but I'm assuming it was an accident. He had somebody build big plywood wings. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, he built a big window shape for somebody to walk through. Mm-hmm. So towards the end of the play... somebody puts those wings on, and it's going to walk through that window, except the wings are too big.
That's
so
perfect.
The actor's literally smashing the plywood right. against the set.
So that's what I mean about this all being like some sort of laboratory experiment that creates problems
yeah.
and disconnects. And
yeah. I think when I arrived, there were... maybe 15 people in the audience. Mm-hmm. And when the play was over, there were three of us.
Yes. Three people who thought it was fabulous, and everybody
right.
else was wondering.
And I afterwards called up Stanley and said, yes, get this guy. This is your, you've got to have this. Richard's doing something amazing here. So
I want to hear about what you did, but first I want to say that you are listening to Live Culture on WPKN 89.5 FM, streaming out of the University of Bridgeport. And this month I'm delighted to have artist Power Booth here with me talking. And right now we're discussing his work in the theater with Richard Foreman and the Ontological Hysterical Theater in New York in the late 60s. So I want to...
I was actually there when he came up with the title of his theater.
I love that. But so, but one of the things, I want to ask you something really specific, because he thinks so visually and make, and like you said, he already made some of his own things. So for you, what was your role? Did you actually get to make what you wanted to make, or did he tell you what to make and you're enacting it for him, which doesn't seem very you?
The truth is, I was rather terrified to be working in theater. It sounded, yeah, our first production together was an opera called Elephant Steps. And Richard works in mysterious ways. He doesn't always explain what he's doing. I mean, his scripts are very peculiar in that regard. They're not your normal script where you're setting a scene and actors act.
Right.
So the summer of 68 at Tanglewood, we put together this opera. And because I'm just coming to it as a visual artist.
Right.
I relied on Richard. I mean, he gave me the design credit, but
But the first he had kind of constructed.
He was really the designer.
And what was interesting to you about doing this? Was it somehow making a structure that's kind of like a painting, but one that you can walk through? Or I'm asking because I've always been, I used to paint for opera, much more traditional opera, but I always liked the weird abstractness of what the paint surfaces looked like before the lighting went on it, before anything. Like I would have to make, I'd have to invent ways of painting huge. So I'd, you know, be skating the paint across the floors and using huge brushes and things to try and cover as much of the surface as possible. It was less about the set per se for me.
Well, I think what I was really drawn to in Richard's work is his process.
Yeah.
For instance, that the wings smashing into the set.
It's fabulous, yeah.
That happens because you're in it. You're making it. Mm-hmm. You don't think of that, I think, while you're writing a script. So his work is very physical and hands-on in that regard. And frankly, he was really writing about what it means to put on a piece of theater.
Right. Yeah, there's something very meta about all of this.
Exactly.
And he sort of inserts himself as writer quite a lot with this narrative voice going over. There's a lot of voiceovers.
And the actors in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I saw the first 12 pieces of his. I just loved his work. I love being in his head.
Right. And it's so different. It still feels
And
really
the
different.
Accident in the process of making something.
Were there a lot of rehearsals to do this? Because this doesn't seem like something you would write out. It seems like something you'd sort of do a schematic for, and then you'd have to get the people and the objects in the space.
Part of his process, which I began to learn about, because I got to know him pretty well, was that he would write dialogue and throw it in a file, literally in a physical file. And then he might pull things together haphazardly.
Like a surrealist game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the accident was really important. And again, he so didn't want acting. He wanted people out there, though. I mean, they were to be performers. But in a very mannered way, too.
I mean, there's a funny emphasis on people being people, but at the same time, it's still very mannered and
totally mannered.
Stylized.
Highly
it's
stylized.
Not, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's...
And later on, I remember seeing a rehearsal. I went to a lot of rehearsals because I like watching him work. And it was like being in a painting, you know, where you think this is going to work and it doesn't.
Yeah.
But something else happens and you have to stay tuned to that and say, oh, actually, that's where this needs to go. And I felt like Richard's rehearsals functioned exactly that way. Mm-hmm. But I saw actors walk off the stage in tears because in a way their training was what Richard was undoing.
There's a lot of that in theater in different ways, like people talk a lot about how abusive and difficult John Cassavetes was, and he would basically kind of strip them down. And his scripts were also really loose because people would be writing as they were rehearsing. But very psychologically fraught. And Rainer Werner Fassbinder, who's one of my favorite directors, was really notable as an unpleasant human being who put every actor who worked for him, you know, in these intense
through hell.
Yes.
Yeah, but Richard wasn't trying.
He wasn't that. He wasn't
to get that emotional
him.
Piece out,
right?
As if that's the authentic thing he wants to
right.
happen on stage,
right? That, he doesn't want them to have a nervous breakdown.
No, that happens during the rehearsals. I think what he was doing in many ways was getting the actor in balance mm-hmm. with the set, the lighting,
right.
the sound.
Right.
And since the actor's already too interesting, he had to...
ratcheting it back.
Yeah, undermine in some ways the actual acting process. Not as an emotional process, but as a kind of visual. I think the visual and the soundscape dominated his work. The last line in Penguin 2K, uh-huh. which was produced at the Public Theater,
yeah,
one of the, I think, great pieces he did, has the last line is, if you see something out of the corner of your eye, do you really see it?
It's one of those things that...
I think
he's
in a way,
head.
Richard was always interested in the thing that happened over in the corner there.
Well, and what, right, what's happening, and is it happening now, and what part is real and what part isn't, what part am I making up?
And yeah, so, and the original title of his theater was... the ontologic hysteric theater
yeah.
upon perception
Ooh.
And accomplishment. And I reminded
that's very
Richard
Victorian
that was when I did a poster for his.
So you did posters as well as the sets.
Yeah, for his Elephant Steps, that whole thing was written out. And then he came back and he told me to take the last part out. It was too much.
Yeah.
And Richard, I think, had forgotten. And I reminded him and he just said, oh, how pretentious.
Well.
But anyway, he was a great guy to work with because of the just playful and way that he engaged of what I thought then of a visual theater. I remember
right.
getting called up by Richard said, you've got to go see Bob Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw an early piece of his in 69 called Einstein. No, it was before Einstein on the Beach, long before. It was King of Spain and A Life and Times of Sigmund Freud,
mm-hmm.
which was done at BAM. And Richard was part of this very visual theater that,
yeah.
in a way, was backing away from the emotional actor
mm-hmm.
on stage, creating
it's
this
yeah, it's interesting
tableau.
That he would want to do opera because opera is usually the sort of swelling of emotion, you know, the hooker with the heart of gold who is dying of emphysema, the, you know, these sort of melodramatic
right.
stories of people having to throw themselves off of precipices. And
so what he featured were big hands.
Mm-hmm.
I had to make big hands that people would, because that was an acting thing.
An acting thing.
Visual acting thing. And a big spoon because we're going to stir.
A some, giant
yeah.
theater spoon.
So the props he was having me make were
obviously outside.
Inflated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Outside visual pieces.
The set that I remember the best, and I think it was from Love and Science, but I'm not sure, was, and you might have made it, it was... a set of almost like police tapes, mm-hmm. a crime scene tape.
Was that at St. Mark's?
Where did I see it? Did I see it at Glimmerglass Opera Company? I can't remember where I saw it. I believe I saw it in New York, but I'm not positive. It could have been upstate. Anyway, it featured a sort of obstacle course of what looked like crime scene tape that the actors had to kind of move through or not move through, a kind of labyrinth that was also bisecting our vision and chopping the space up very weirdly.
Sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah. But it was incredibly visual because it was like these lines moving through space, but then the actors had to navigate that. And sometimes they would be knowingly crossing the line and other times not.
I worked for the first on his first five pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And then I no longer worked with him, but I saw as much as I could see.
I was interested in what you said about it being like paintings, because the way you described paintings is, I think, something that anybody who makes paintings knows, these kinds of conversations that you have with yourself about what's working and what's not working. And what's interesting about it is that you do end up having these conversations and sort of fighting with yourself. And I always feel like one of the hard parts about painting is, and art making in general, is that you're always looking at your own dumb brain at the end of the day. Like, there, you know,
totally frustrating.
I look at some of the things that I've made, I'm like, is this really the best I can do? Is that really the best? And it's like, yeah, that's really the best you can do. Right now, that is the best you can do. And then later on, more positively, I'll look back and I'm like, oh, that's actually, you know, that's better than I thought. But you are looking at your own limitations and frailties and anxieties as you're trying to solve things that have to do with other things in the world.
So the philosopher Gadamer,
mm-hmm.
in the early part of Truth and Method, his book, his sort of major book, talks about the artwork as an invitation to play.
Mm-hmm.
In a way, I feel,
yeah.
If you don't understand that,
yeah.
It's not a, you can talk yourself into a very analytical perspective if you want.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all play.
Yes.
It's serious play.
It's serious play, right. It's play in the best way, because you really, you know, you're thinking through things, and it's not always a linear thought, and it's not always about a direct line of communication to other people. It's not like broadcasting something, but it is. It's a rumination or a meditation.
In that book, he's talking about plays.
Mm-hmm.
So you walk into a theater, and then these people who actually exist walk out on stage. And
people who actually exist.
Right. But now they become fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're going to act something out.
Right.
And now you're going to engage them.
Mm-hmm.
And take them in.
Right. And so in some ways, they are going to be a facet of you. You're going to empathize with them as they go through whatever it is that they're guiding you through.
And Gadamer's phrase for that is fabulous. And that is, the play plays you.
The play plays you. Yes. That's lovely. So what book is that?
It's called Truth and Method.
Truth and Method.
And
is that a favorite of yours?
It was. I mean, so another way we could go with this conversation is how rich it was for me in New York,
mm-hmm.
to be working with Richard, seeing dance performances.
Right.
Across the street was...
You were in Soho.
I was actually down in what later would be become Tribeca.
Mm-hmm.
When I'm thinking about this period.
So much going on and so many great performers and so much
experimentation. And we're all kind of living down in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a local cafeteria called the Tower Cafeteria,
mm-hmm.
That Arthur and Joan Panzer owned and ran. And you got to know her or them because they just hung out, mm-hmm. in the cafeteria. But who's having breakfast there usually is Richard Serra, Philip, mm-hmm. Glass, and Philip probably is working with Richard on various projects at that point. And I'm, they're doing plumbing.
Yeah, no,
and then I
love
get involved
this story.
Doing plumbing
talk, yes.
with him. But across the street.
I love the idea that Richard Serra and Philip Glass are doing plumbing.
Yeah, yeah. It's not.
So was this place kind of like the Cedar Bar of your day? I don't want to say
but,
it your day.
But it's the morning. Like, it's yeah. breakfast.
Yeah.
You know?
But I mean, it's the place it's, that you would drop in and you would run into yeah. a sort of critical yeah. mass of
and because
art
I was working with Richard and mm-hmm. Philip was married to Joanne Acolatis, then I got involved with Joanne's. She developed Mabu Minds as
right.
a theater group.
One of the
so
great
I
theater companies.
Worked with them. Mm-hmm. And then Gene Heistein, who's the cousin of Phil's, married to Lana Heist at the mm-hmm. time, comes
from Clock
in.
Tower.
And now he and I become plumbing partners
uh-huh.
and take over Richard and Philip's
plumbing business.
Plumbing business.
So you supported yourself as an artist doing plumbing projects?
There was...
For a little bit of time.
No, for a lot.
For a lot.
Time.
For
yeah.
a lot of time.
Oh, yeah.
So one of the things that I think we should talk about is how, you know, the way that you can kind of, in the past, you could kind of drop into a world like New York and find things in a kind of haphazard way.
Find people
and get things going and live on very little.
Absolutely. Yeah. The rent was astonishingly low.
Right.
Because it was illegal to live in these places. So nobody would think to live there except us artists.
But it was a hospitable culture for artists.
Absolutely.
Because New York is much less hospitable
because
now.
Because you need space.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Now I don't know how you do it.
So I just want to say that you were listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and streaming online at WPKN.org. And this is Live Culture. It's a monthly program discussing arts and ideas. I'm your host, Martha Willett Lewis, and I am delighted to be talking with artist Power Booth today. And we're talking right now about the art world in New York in the late 60s.
Early 70s.
Early 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. Very fluid.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing. I think you didn't have to have a major plan. And even much later, when I was an art student and then starting at work in New York, there were all kinds of jobs and internships. And I didn't have a master plan. I just kind of floated along and was lucky.
Years later, I would get asked, well, how do you do this? How do you go to New York? How does you make that happen?
How do you go to New York?
And I said, well, if you're trying to figure it out, you'll never go.
Yeah.
Just go.
Just go.
Yeah.
Right. Except that now I'm not sure. It's really expensive. Many of the galleries have dried up. There's a lot of, there are some sort of more experimental places, but the real question of where the money comes from that's going to feed you and keep you going is a very reasonable question.
Yeah, I felt like only in retrospect can I look back and say, well, how extraordinary that was.
Yeah.
Because everybody was accessible. There wasn't a lot of money mm-hmm. involved. And you could do it on a few dollars a day. You could have a meal in Chinatown for 60 cents. You know,
yeah.
you could
yeah.
eat at Finelli's Bar for $1.50. And the Subway was 10 cents.
Yeah.
So,
and now the Subway is quite expensive. I remember in college, I would eat at the Polish diners or the Ukrainian diners around the corner from Cooper Union. And it was $1.25 for
on
soup
2nd
and
3rd Avenue
yeah.
there. Yeah.
Yeah. Soup and challah bread, $1.25.
Did it many times.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, there was a, because I think as a young artist, you've got to find a community.
Yeah.
And you've got to find space. So that was what was extraordinary about New York then.
Right.
Space
it
was
offered
available
those things.
Because it was all illegal to live there, and you wink, wink, mm-hmm. lived in your space. And yet the landlord could throw you out at any time.
Sure.
So there's a kind of way in which that cuts out a lot of people who are nervous about
fire hazards.
Or that's not fire hazards so much as
regular showers.
That you could lose. Why am I going to pay rent if I could just, you know, why would I move in there?
The lack of security.
But we had to move in
yeah.
there. And it was cheap, very cheap. A 2,000 square foot loft could rent for $150.
See, it's
because it was storage space. Right. And you had to take out a whole bunch of furniture or bolts of cloth that are just...
Right. I think this is important to say that it's not like you just got some sort of immaculate loft for that. You actually had to make the place livable, and it may not have enough heat or
no hot water.
Right.
There's no kitchen. You're going to build that in.
Yeah.
So in a way, I went to work.
It's a good thing you were a plumber.
Yeah. Actually, I found the plumbing was great because you start off at the beginning of the project while the customer still had money. Mm-hmm. It's actually at the end that it gets iffy. But and they don't know. Plumbing just seems so mysterious, but it's pretty practical and pretty straightforward. So you put in the plumbing and then you come back and put in the fixtures. Mm-hmm. You got two phases and hope you can get the last check.
Right. One is the behind the scenes and the other one is the front of house.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you need it inspected, I had to go and I had a guy named Henry Green who was had a plumbing license. So I could get him to come in and walk through a job.
Right.
And
make sure it was up to.
To me, how did we do this over here? And then I would remind him. But of course, Henry hadn't seen the job until the day he walked in with the inspector. But all of this is how New York kind of worked then. And I think the important piece is the conversation that goes around in art. It's why the critique is so important in art. Because, you know, an artwork as an invitation to play is also an invitation to play with ideas.
And, absolutely.
And so you have these conversations. With other people who are looking, because there's a lot of slippage in what something means. That's part of the playfulness of all that. And I think...
Yeah, language is not fixed.
Yeah, because ultimately it's back to something felt. Mm-hmm. And that felt coherence is an embodied response. And yet we work with words, so we're going to try to talk about that. But we know that what we're saying is hinting at something out of the corner of your eye.
Do you think that that's one of the most important things about art school or being an educator is the process of critique?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do. I do. And it's not a phony process because, in fact, what an artwork does is provoke conversation.
Yeah.
That's why we go. And we come away and we talk about it and we think about it.
Conversations are sometimes, you know, I look at some paintings and they kind of make my head sing in a certain way. A conversation is sort of too
verbal. But you know it's not it.
Pardon me?
You know the conversation. You know the words aren't it. That's what's so nice about it.
Right. Like certain Kandinsky paintings, it's just like some sort of piece of music going off in my head.
Absolutely.
It's, you know, I go there to visit them, and I guess it's like a conversation with me and the piece, but it's not a verbal conversation exactly.
So a very famous mural of 5th century Athens is the painted Stoa. Mm-hmm. And we know from descriptions what was going on. It represented the battle at Marathon and various other battles, and here's Athena, and here's...
Right. But that doesn't
describe it. But the mural's gone.
Yeah.
So we can't know it.
Yeah.
That description, that conversation is still going on, but it can't... We need to go see it.
Right. It's an inadequate description.
To actually see it. Mm-hmm. You can't just talk about Richard's work. You have to...
Go see it.
Experience a play.
Well, one of the things that I love about visual things is the way that you can so densely and yet concisely layer things. There's so many kinds of conversations that you can have in one piece all at once.
Absolutely, yeah.
And you can unpack it in a kind of leisurely way or just focus on one part of it. But... unlike verbal things, it would take a lot of words to describe what a lot of paintings do, or what a lot of, not just paintings, a lot of images do.
I'm working with a group of students right now at Five Points Gallery. I'm starting a seminar there, which is called the Five Points Seminar.
So I want to go back and talk more specifically, go back to what we were talking about with New York and what younger people can do now. But anyway, please tell us about the seminar.
And again, this connects to New York.
Right. No, that's what I thought.
In some ways, this is the kind of community that can you can find now.
Right.
It's different than New York City, but you can't. I don't know how you do it in New York anymore.
You have to do different things in different points in time.
Right. So you've got to be flexible in that regard. I just want to throw this piece in, which is, so we started talking about a painting that I am always working on, and it's at the Frick, and it's Vermeer's Maid with Mistress.
Yes.
Maid and Mistress. And the maid is reading a letter to the mistress, and the mistress is reacting. There are so many layers to this piece, and it hooks you in, and the idea that the visual just is kind of a little engine that keeps running, because you can't sum it up in words. You have to experience it, but we could talk around it.
And talking around it is fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not unpleasant to do that, but it's not the same as the pleasure of kind of hovering over the painting itself and letting it sink
in. I like that, hovering.
Mm-hmm.
We hover.
Yeah, I like to think of myself as a little hummingbird zooming around. So at Five Points, which is in Torrington, what is your official capacity there? You're involved with the work that they do.
So I got a phone call 7 years ago, because there was a, I didn't know Judith McElhone, who was putting together a pop-up show and invited me to show. And
I live in Harwinton.
Mm-hmm. So I said, great, let me be part of this. And as I got to know Judith and we got to see what was going on here, Judith was forming a board and I became a founding board member, and Ann Temkin, who is the curator at Museum of Modern Art, came by.
Wow. To your gallery in Torrington.
But she grew up in Torrington.
Ah.
And so she and Judith were old friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you got to put her on the board.
Right.
So we started inventing a board, and
did you get the building after the
We never owned that building. We're still there.
So
we're on Water Street, downtown Torrington. And Five Points means there's five roads that come together at that corner where Five Points Gallery is. And it's a space that we rent from.
Okay, you rent it.
Yeah. But it's made, the partners who are involved in the ownership of that building understood almost day one that this was changing Torrington, that was having an impact, that we had life in the middle of Torrington. And that's what the arts do.
I think it's amazing that you can have a gallery that's as vibrant as it is. This is nothing against Torrington. It's just that in the middle of a town in Connecticut.
Well, it's the vision of Judith.
Right.
Judy's remarkable. She keeps seeing, okay, well, what if we did this and what if we did this? And she got a board around her. I'm no longer on the board, but I was for the first 7 years. I just stepped off because we've got board bylaws that say I have to step off. But the board around her now loves this gallery and Torrington. And now, in the last year or so, we had the opportunity to purchase and actually own a piece of property. And that's the UConn campus in the northern part of Torrington.
Okay, so I want to talk about that in a second, but I want to say about Five Points. So not only does it have art exhibits, but you also have some gallery space upstairs. And as I understand it, that's a space for younger people to live in.
It's called the Launch Pad.
Right. And speaking of supporting students and younger artists, they get involved with the gallery. They intern, or is that part of the deal? How does that work? Because it's a great program. It's a really good idea.
We understood that a need that we could help young artists fulfill was, how do you build a community? Where do you go after you graduate?
Yeah.
So between a number of universities, University of Harvard, Hartford Art School and UConn and other universities. You can apply as a student to get a studio space for very reasonable amounts of money and to join this group. Right now, there's 17 students in what's called the launch pad.
That's
and
terrific.
That's the floor above. And in a way, we're creating a community of like-minded individuals who are in and out of each other's studios. And I think this is the kind of
Kind of thing that recent graduates really need, too. It can be very isolating. I remember finishing school, and it was really rough. It's, you know. So you were starting to talk about a really exciting, much bigger project that Five Points is involved in, and I want you to elaborate to the extent that you can about that, too, because the vision of this gallery has gone from a place to show some contemporary art, you know, group shows and things, to a place to launch younger artists, and now you've got this enormous
campus. By accident.
Yeah.
UConn had a president of the University of UConn who decided to get rid of I think they've gotten rid of all the satellite campuses because they just weren't economically sound for the university. And so what became available is 30,000 square feet of a campus with 90 acres of woodlands north of the northern border of Torrington. So once we became aware that this was going on the market, it has it needed an educational purpose because that's what endowed the campus to begin with. Mm-hmm. So that cut out a lot of people. And there were a number of institutions that involved in education that were interested, but we became the final.
And what is it, or what will it be, and when will it
be? So we will purchase this. Mm-hmm. There's nobody else involved
in the mix anymore, right?
And we're finalizing all of that, and it'll be probably in our hands March 1st.
And is it going to be called Five Points, and what will it do?
It'll be under the umbrella of the Five Points now Center for the Visual Arts. We've changed the name. It's
Center
not just Five Points
Arts,
Gallery, because we're in...
More
than
an
a
art
gallery
center.
Now.
Yeah.
Yeah. But we're not, we're an art center, and it's going to be very organic how we develop it. But we imagine, say, 10 years from now, I can imagine artists coming in to do projects that might happen in the woods, might be part of an art park.
Environmental projects.
Environmental projects. We're going to be a very green institution. We are going to have studios. We're going to have workshops. We're going to have artists coming in to maybe do a workshop for a semester or a number of months in printmaking or photography or sculpture or painting or...
So you'll have residents.
Residents, yeah.
Terrific.
And then we'll bring in students who might work on a project with a particular artist. And until we actually get our hands on it, we're not fully aware of every detail at this point, but this is where we're going with it. And it's going to happen because Five Points Gallery didn't exist 7 years ago.
Yeah.
The astonishing thing is the board and the town have really supported this adventure.
I think it's a great idea, and I also think that you don't need to have it all decided ahead of time. I think there's a great deal to be said for trying things out and figuring out what works and what artists need and what the local community needs. What do people need? What do they want out of art and artists in their community, as well as what do artists want and need? And the other thing that I really like is that it can address lots of kinds of projects, very multimedia things. You've got enough space that you can do theater, you can do environmental projects, you can, you know, be flexible about what your programs are, rather than developing a full roster of projects and then sort of imposing
them
on.
Well, think of Soho.
Yeah.
It didn't happen because somebody had a plan and goals and, okay, now you have to do this.
Right. I'm against the plan, I guess I would say.
Well, and Eisenhower famously said, you know, it's the planning, not the plan. because the plan's
that's
wrong.
Very good. It's the action, right? The activity.
The plan is, planning is incredibly important.
Right.
We are looking at every possible way we can make this work, but we're not going to be handicapped by the plan because we know it's too organic. It's going to be dependent on people too.
Yeah.
And the artists that show up.
Right.
You can't just say those are positions, you know, like
right.
that artist is going to do that and that's part of our plan. No, that's a particular artist who's going to do this and it's going to change everything because of that artist.
Which is fantastic. It's is this on the website? Is there more that people could find out if they go?
It will be soon. We can't jump the gun until we own it.
Okay. So stay tuned.
Yes, stay tuned.
So 5 points, do you know what their website is?
Oh, yeah, you can find the website. That's not a problem at all.
What is it?
It's 5 points.
Fivepoints.com.
Yeah.
.org. Right.
Just Google 5 points. You're going to be right there.
So we're running out of time now. This is WPKN Bridgeport, 89.5 FM and streaming online at WPKN.org. This program is Live Culture. I'm your host, Martha Willett Lewis, and I'm talking right now with Power Booth, who is an artist and educator and thinker, and we are discussing recent activity at Five Points Art Center in Torrington, which is expanding exponentially as we speak.
I'm going to shift over to the shameless promotional part.
Oh, yeah, please do. Please do. We have a few minutes left, so please promote.
I'm going to have a show at 5 points.
Of what?
My work.
Painting? No, but I mean...
Yeah.
My paintings.
And it's new work and mm-hmm. older work. So we're going to kind of take over the whole space as far as we're discussing right now.
It's a survey?
It's not fully formed. Yeah, kind of survey of the last 10 years, maybe.
So
that will be... October 8th,
and you'll have it, and you'll have an opening, and people can sign up. If you go to the 5 points website, you can sign up for mailing lists, in which case you'll get invited to the opening, which is free and open to
absolutely
the public.
Absolutely free, yeah.
So one could go see it and meet Power oneself. So do you have a title for this? Do you have an appealing and scintillating, or is that not your style?
It's not my style.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do themes.
and
so it will probably just be work by Power Booth. It's not a...
And can you just, in a few words, roughly describe what your work is? I realize we haven't talked about that at all. We've been assuming that everybody already knows.
Well, nobody knows about art. Even I.
They're painting.
Come and see it. And that's probably the best thing I could say. It's abstract work, but I'm an abstract artist like many abstract artists who love Vermeer, love Rembrandt.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, it's all abstract. And it's not abstract in some non-emotional sense. If we think of art as an invitation to play,
yeah,
it's the whole...
I think that's a very generous way of thinking about art.
Embodied sense of play. You know,
right.
It's fun. And it's emotional. You know, it's mm-hmm. not a
it's
cold...
It's not clinical and it's not sterile.
And the truth is, Mondrian is not clinical.
Oh, Mondrian... Broadway Boogie Woogie is one of my favorite paintings. And the song, the music just dances in my
but
head.
But how he made them.
So rhythmic.
You know, he is just... putting everything out of balance so the whole can be in balance.
Yeah.
But not part to part.
Right.
And it's a felt thing. It's not a mathematical thing in the sense of math being some formula. It's a highly tuned up, felt, playful act. And if you think of Mondrian as something cold and clinical, you... are missing the work.
I think that sums it up. Is it Susan Rothenberg who did the painting of Mondrian dancing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a little. Because
Mondrian loved to go out and
dance. He loved to dance, and on the other hand, he found trees disturbingly
Yeah, he didn't like green.
He did not like
green.
The trees.
If it's too green out, he shut the window because it was just annoying. On the other hand, painted the most beautiful flowers. The chrysanthemum paintings are astonishing. So it's all there.
It is all in there, regardless of, sometimes it's not the artist's intention. Power, I want to thank you for being on Live Culture.
This was fun.
It was a lot of fun. Stay tuned next month. Please join us next month. I'm here on the final Saturday of the month from 11 until 12 noon. And of course, it's available on archive for 2 weeks afterwards. And then it will be up as a podcast forever on SoundCloud, iTunes, and the whole rest of it. So thank you so much for being part of Live Culture.
Thanks, Martha.
Bye-bye.
Support for WPKN comes from Premier Concerts and Manic Presents, bringing singer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Grace Potter with guest singer-songwriter Devin Gilfillian to College Street Music Hall in New Haven on Tuesday, January 28th. Tickets available at collegestreetmusichall.com.
Kevin Gallagher here. My next guest on Digging in the Dirt was almost here once before. Her bout with the flu has passed, and now the wonderful Naomi Oreskes will join me at 5 p.m. on January 27th to discuss the fight to wake the public up to the climate crisis and hold those who are irresponsibly continuing to promote the fossil fuel age accountable. Naomi Oreskes is a professor of the history of science at Harvard and one of the leading experts on the climate crisis. Testifying before Congress twice last year, she is also author of the important book on climate change denialism called The Merchants of Doubt. Join me on my next Digging in the Dirt with Naomi Oreskes here on listener-supported WPKN.
All the news that's fit to print and democracy dies in darkness. Two taglines of two major American news organizations, the New York Times and the Washington Post. WPKN is proud to offer digital subscriptions to both publications. Become a monthly sustaining supporter at $15 per month, and you can have your pick of either paper for a one-year subscription. So if you already have the New York Times at home, consider adding the Washington Post. In the process, you're helping support WPKN, nonprofit community radio. Make your sustaining donation to WPKN today, online at WPKN.org. It will be a decision you will enjoy every single day of the year.
After years in the making, the Bridgeport Portrait Project will open on Saturday, January 25th at the University of Bridgeport's Shelf Out Gallery. The exhibition is a passion project of creators and photographers Jay Misnick and Geraldine Valentine, who, in 2015, began documenting people of Bridgeport who make the city more than just a place. The exhibit includes more than 150 photo portraits, as well as video and storytelling. It will be on view through March 28th. The opening of the Bridgeport Portrait Project, which is public and free, is from 2 to 4 p.m. on Saturday, January 25th at UB's Shelf Out Gallery, 84 Aransastan Avenue in Bridgeport. Information and links can be found on the WPKN community calendar at WPKN.org.
Hi, I'm Terry Smith, Creative Director at Franklin Streetworks. We're a nonprofit contemporary art space and cafe in Stamford, Connecticut. We curate three group exhibitions each year, and many address social issues such as immigrant rights, LGBTQ themes, and the environment. We have shown more than 350 artists from around the world, including many emerging artists who have gone on to show at major museums such as the Whitney Museum of American Art. Our exhibitions and educational programming are free and open to the public. More information is at our website, franklinstreetworks.org, or on our Facebook page.
Creative Arts Workshop, located in New Haven, Connecticut, has been serving artists of all ages and abilities since 1961. Creative Arts Workshop provides programs in book arts, painting, photography, printmaking, and more. More information about the Creative Arts Workshop is available at www.creativeartsworkshop.org or at 203-562-4927.
Project Music is a new nonprofit music education program in Stamford, Connecticut, providing free instruments and training to inner-city youth in need of opportunity and inspiration. Modeled after Venezuela's landmark El Sistema program, Project Music uses music to cultivate fundamental life skills such as leadership and creativity. In partnership with the Chester Addison Community Center, Domus, Project Music invites the community to contribute whatever time, talent, and treasure possible. Please visit www.projectmusic.org.
Hi, this is Mystery Girl, host of Shut Up and Listen, and you're listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, independent community radio, broadcasting from the campus of the University of Bridgeport, also streaming at WPKN.org.
What a story, what a story, what a story.